spike heels for the S&M crowd, frills for the shy, bright lips for blowjobs, plaid skirts for the spankers. They laughed and played like kids do when they're desperate to get in just a little more fun before they're called for bedtime. Like little girls in dress-up, high-heel shoes, bright blouses and skirts, they twisted and pranced for potential customers. They wore wigs that were unnaturally straight or blonde or red. Salt's mother had always dressed her up for church in dresses that felt like Halloween costumes. Sometimes she liked them. They are precious in his sight. Jesus loves the little children of the world. These ladies were probably not the children of the world the Sunday school teachers had in mind. Glenda wore a day-glow green tube dress that conveniently rode up her broad backside, which rumbled when she walked. Roxanne was in pink pleather, Black Sally with her thigh-high boots, Jojo in feathers. There was a new girl. Salt rubbed her eyes and got out of the patrol car. Salt had worked vice details, dressed up, done the stroll in front of this place, escorted Johns into the shabby rooms where they were arrested by her partners. She could feel how her feet hurt in whore-heel shoes, feel the anxiety of how it would go down once the man or men were trapped in the room, the takedown team flipping out shields. Johns almost always fought, unsure if it was an arrest or a robbery. On a detail last year, a man had presented her with a cat of nine tails, beautifully wrapped in florist's paper. Beat me? He also wanted pins stuck in his dick. You costing us dates, Salt, the girls protested weakly, pointing at the black and white parked in the drive. But none of them turned down the bottled water she brought. The hot air was dry and gritty. Where's Pepper tonight? Roxanne, the only white whore at Calvin's, asked. That started them all on a roll. That man so fine, I'd do him for free, said Glenda, the street smartest, oldest on the avenue. Ooh-wee, he shined like new money. His mama and daddy was making love when he got made, 'cause don't nobody that good-looking come from just fucking. Salt was laughing, drinking her water, sitting on the trunk of the cruiser, her boots propped on the bumper while the cars passed by. It was like having friends as a kid might have felt, someone to play dress-up with. All these prostitutes she knew, except for the new young one, who had on such heavy makeup it was hard to tell her age, her arms and legs smooth and unbruised. She was wearing a tight black miniskirt and a see-through black lace top. A blonde wig fell to her shoulders, and she kept swatting the hair back from her eyes, like she'd never worn hair that wasn't her own. Salt caught her attention and asked, "What name do you go by?" The others answered, laughing. "We call her Peaches, 'cause she just got fuzz down there." "How old are you?" Peaches didn't seem to know whether to stay or go back to her room. The mood with the girls was still light, but she kept looking from Salt to the girls, all laughing together. Peaches answered, "It's my birthday. I'm 17 today." The laughing stopped. They looked to Glenda, who opened the snap of a tiny purse she had taken from where it was hidden in her tight top. "Come here," she said to the girl, and gave her a $5 bill. "You take this and go buy a cake. You ain't working tonight." All the girls retrieved money from their various caches, and each gave something to Peaches. Salt slid off the trunk and took a five from her uniform pocket. "Happy birthday, Peaches. You got your ID?" Peaches went into her room and came back with an out-of-state ID card that listed her age as 17 today. She probably had other IDs and any number of birth dates. Salt moved her own birthday around when anyone came close to making her celebrate. But here in Wonderland, Alice or Peaches or most anyone could be as big or small or old or young as she wanted to be. Many of them had followed the white rabbit of cocaine down the hole. Several more cars came through the motel drive and then sped up at the side of the patrol car. Roxanne was the first to say it, serious. You messin' with business now. I'm outta here, ladies. Salt ambivalently turned toward her car, the festive mood broken. They were getting antsy for her to move on. Pimps had to be paid. Drugs had to be scored. Babies needed milk. Glenda moved the girl with the $5 bills in her hand off to the side while the others went back to their doors. Salt had cut Glenda breaks over the years. Famous for blowjobs, missing two top front teeth, she smiled often, but with her lips closed until she was ready to work. "Question, Glenda," Salt said, and waited for her to come close. "You seen Dirty Red lately?" A blue sedan with two older men drove through. Glenda stopped smiling.
"We ain't seen her in a while."
"Where would she hang when she wasn't here?" Glenda shifted from one hip to the other.
"She sometimes turned tricks over on Jonesboro."
"She have a house or apartment to use?"
"Her sister stays around there somewhere."
She bit at a cuticle while she watched the entrance. "Did you ever know her real name?"
"Matter of fact, I do. I know 'cause she had to tell it when we got arrested together one time. Her real name is something Stone. I don't remember the first name since everybody calls her Dirty."
Salt stood very still. "How do you know she gave her real name?"
"The vice guys know her already, so she can't give no false name."
"You know if she has other family nearby?"
"Yeah, 'cause she told me one time her brother put her in the hospital. He beat her so bad. It was her little brother, but I guess he must have not been too little."
They stood together, both stiff, arms folded across their chests, and watched while a cab pulled in. The birthday girl, now with money, got in to go get her cake. "You want my card or anything? Can you call me at the precinct and leave a message if you hear from Dirty Red?" She moved to the cruiser. Glenda held out her hand, waggling her fingers.
"You done helped me before. Give me your card."
A part of her wished she could just sit the rest of the night joking with the girls. But they and Salt knew it was time for Salt to go. She was keeping the Johns away, and they had dues to pay on debts they'd never owed. Glenda took the card and walked down the drive toward the entrance. Radio was calling on a dispatch for possible child molestation in the homes. Chapter 16. Sam's and the Cappuccino Cafe. The next day, first thing out of the precinct, she went down Pryor, under the abandoned, rusting train trestle, the railroad easement thick in kudzu, past a city equipment yard, rusting iron and steel beams, bars, rebar, and rails visible above the latticed fence. She left after roll call with the purpose of letting Lil D know that she'd found his father, that Big D was sick, and to relay Big D's claim of not having killed Chanel. The drug trade slowed around this time every day. Only one runner needed in the hole. She was fairly sure it would be Lil D, like it was most days. At the intersection next to Sam's Chicken Shack, street signs had been down for so long, some said it was now the corner of nothing and nothing. Sam's faced East Nothing. The street on the north side of Sam's was actually named Joyland, and the irony of the street name was not lost on those who frequented the area. There was a hollowness in Salt's stomach, a hungry, sick feeling. She couldn't guess if Lil D would listen to anything she had to say. On one side of Sam's, there was a concrete foundation of some former building. Beside it was a pole with a small, raggedy billboard that depicted a young woman with a prominent rear holding a sweating can of malt liquor. Among the debris in the lot was an upholstered rose floral pillow. On the other side of Joyland was a strip mall of vacant shops, a small market for meat, produce, and beer, a closed beeper business, and God's World Ministries church. Here, most legitimate businesses failed. What survived was the drug trade. God's World had the earth and its continents amateurishly painted on the front window. Clouds obscured parts of North America. Florida was shaped like a penis. Both sides of Sam's were covered in graffiti that overlaid peeling posters for rap shows and horror movies. One piece of graffiti in black contained the word neck, the rest of the lettering indecipherable. A crumbling low concrete wall circumscribed the perimeter of the business. There was no drive-through or sit-down, only the walk-up window, under an overhang that dangled sections of aluminum roofing. Sam's was not inside the homes proper, but yet was its center. Everyone went to Sam's. The drug boys ate and took their own orders at Sam's. Courtships, friendships, and neighborliness happened at Sam's. Another afternoon storm was passing as she pulled into the parking lot. Patches of light came and went between the parting clouds. The rain had cleared most people from the dope corner, but Lil D was standing alone under the ragged overhang, eating from a styrofoam box. Sam's chicken sure wasn't making him fat. She parked in front of the takeout window and got out. No other customers. Sam's face and shoulders filled the small window under the "Order Here" sign. Lil D gnawed the last bite from a drumstick and flipped the container into a trash can. "Let me have a minute to decide," she told Sam. He flung a greasy hand towel over his beefy shoulder and lumbered toward the back. Lil D was close under the overhang. Keeping her face toward the empty order window, Salt said, "I found Big D and talked to him." She put her hand on the buckle of her belt at the hollow of her belly. "I know you ain't trying to speak to me." He looked away, his expression making it hard to tell if he cared. There was a little smear of grease on his chin. Salt resisted the urge to take up a napkin to wipe it. He was again dressed in fresh clothes, his small frame engulfed in shiny, baggy blue mid-calf shorts and matching shirt. Being in the hole was paying something. "Meet me over behind the school in 20 minutes, she said. Lil D pushed off the wall and sprinted out into the receding rain. He went in the opposite direction from the school. She waited a minute, then called Sam. "I'm not hungry. Could I just get a can of soda?" Sam handed it to her, unopened, knowing cops were particular that way. Didn't take it personal. She got in her car and sat watching Lil D's figure recede in the distance. Pepper pulled into the lot, his tires making splashes through the crater-like potholes, then parked so they were driver's side to driver's side. The rain-streaked windows made Pepper look like he was melting. Quickly as it came, the rain stopped completely, and steam began rising from the pavement. As they lowered their windows, the washed air offered welcome refreshment. "Be sure to tell Anne that I enjoyed the afternoon." Saturday, she had taken Wonder to Pepper's suburban two-story house for a backyard picnic. Pepper's boys, Theo and Miles, loved her dog, and their energy was a match for his. They had thrown the frisbee till their arms were worn out. Pepper had the grill going. The backyard grass had been recently cut, and the sprinkler was on for the boys and dog to run through. Another water hose was attached to a slip-and-slide, and Wonder chased along as the boys skidded on their bellies. The day had felt light, and she was a part of it. Her head and eyes were clear the whole afternoon. Rhythm from the boombox was under it all. After a few beers, unable to resist Aretha Franklin's respect, she'd grabbed Wonder's frisbees and began a routine with Wonder, jumping for multiple discs, flying over her arms to make catches. Pepper and Anne were yelling, "What on earth?" and "Oh, no!" laughing, falling out of their chairs. The boys clapped and danced, skinny-legged. It had been a good day, with a smell of sunlight, damp boys, and her dog.
"You and that dog are quite a pair. I think you need an agent."
Pepper smiled from his window now. "The boys loved it, but it makes me think you spend too much time alone with that dog."
"Oh, here we go again. Salt, you need a man. When you gonna go on a date? I've got somebody you need to meet."
"Well, excuse me if Ann and I want you to be happy," Pepper said,
actually looking hurt. "I know you want me to be hooked up." She was sneaking a glance in the rearview mirror, briefly considering how she looked to a regular guy, when her attention was drawn to a car passing the corner. "There goes Johnny C. in a car with a broken vent window." She was already moving her foot to the gas. Pepper slammed his car in gear and took off, following her out of the parking lot. She'd bet a paycheck that was half dead in the passenger seat. Johnny C., man's brother, and gang member half dead would definitely be a score for Salt in her war with man. She was logging onto the computer, screen set to run tags for stolen, while she drove. "Run, run," she said, vibing the boys in the car, anticipating the chase, her body confident. Then she thought about Lil D, waiting behind the school. What if he had turned the corner and changed direction? There was no time to choose. She bore down on the boys, whose arrest might lead to information about who killed Lil D's mother. After going north, then making a few turns, they changed direction and went south on Hill, at just under the speed limit. She was following a pace back, holding off, until the computer reported the status of the Buick. Johnny C's silhouette kept turning toward his rearview mirror. "Radio, I'm following an older model, tan Buick, busted vent, occupied two times, tag Adam, Adam, Michael, 236, confirm status, south on Hill from Park." She kept her movements casual, the speed low, timing radio transmissions so that Johnny C. and Half Dead wouldn't notice she was on her radio. Pepper had turned off and was following on a parallel street. The screen on the computer lit up. The familiar high rush of excitement was in her breath. "Radio, I have confirmation." Pepper responded, "Radio, I'm close by for an assist." Several more officers jumped at the chance to be a part of a pursuit. Salt heard them reporting locations, whether they were or were not precisely there, making sure to report nearby so they could reasonably be part of the chase. Sirens wailed behind their transmissions. She held off on the blue lights until other units were in place, not wanting to spook the boys any more than they already were. "Radio, we're still southbound, approaching Englewood." The Buick slowed. Johnny C. signaled for a turn into the Englewood projects when he noticed Pepper's cruiser at the intersection. Englewood was an area notorious for harboring car thieves, experts, juveniles as young as 12 and 13 heisting vehicles. On the hills above, the streets had been cut to dead ends when the projects had been built, perfect drop-off points for stolen cars. Perpetrators chased by police could jump out and have a downhill run through the kudzu and into the apartments below.
3305, I got the dead ends covered, reported Big Fuzzy. 3304, I'm at the bottom, Blessing called out.
She turned on her blues. Pepper responded with his. Come on, give us a real run, she prayed, not wanting to lose her high. Salt was a short skid mark from the stolen car. Pepper blocked their access to home base, and Johnny C. shot past, south on Hill, Salt and Pepper on his tail. She grinned and felt lifted on buzzed air. We are running. Hill came to a T at University, where another unit was screaming up at them in the opposite lanes. The Buick made a fishtail right onto University, barely avoiding eastbound cars. They busted the light at Pryor and beat the cops to the only available route, the entrance ramp to the expressway. It was the ramp nearest her beat, one she'd traveled many times and one time too many. Without warning, a blur caught the edge of Salt's vision. She held her breath, lips tight, but the smell and taste of gunpowder filled her mouth and nose. Instead of slowing, she gunned the Crown Vic past the scene of her shooting. Gritting her teeth, forcing air to her lungs, pumping more adrenaline, tightening her hands on the wheel, and clearing her eyes, she found herself inches from the bumper of the stolen car. Tires squealing, the boys gunned it into the downtown connector filled with commuters. In an attempt to lose the cops, Johnny barreled across six lanes, leaving in his wake swerving cars, braking, screeching tires, and a few broken bumpers. Salt and Pepper, sirens yowling, were joined by two cars from the adjacent zone. Traffic parted for the blue lights. These boys, trained to steal close to home, were now headed toward the rest of the city. She backed off in caution, but continued to call the chase. Radio, we're northbound on 7585. They've caused a minor accident at Pine Street. Notify Zone 5. Injuries unlikely. Suspect is doing about 80 miles per hour in the HOV, passing 10th. Now there was no exit available for the pursued. They were blocked in an HOV lane that would carry them to another expressway and out of any territory familiar to them. She gunned it, settling on the perp's tail. Pepper pulled up on their right side, showing them there was no way out. They swerved, feigning a swipe at Pepper, who was grinning. The speed racers were likely lost. The expressway divided, and 75 went off to the left with the HOV lane. Pepper had to drop back at the split, and the perps saw their chance. They shot into the right lane and headed for the exit. She advised radio, "Notify Zone 2. The perps have gotten off at north side." The Buick rode up the left-hand side of the exit ramp, eating shrubs, squealing past cars stopped at the light, then turned left. "Radio, they're southbound on north side, 50 miles per hour. Their undercarriage is damaged, dragging metal, showing sparks." Salt was right on Johnny C., hugging every turn. A voiceover, the academy instructor's commands. "Threshold braking, shuffle steering, hands at 2 and 10. As natural now as lifting her feet to run. Then, in an instant, an echo voice. "I wanted to teach you to drive." Her father's plaintive whisper. She inhaled smoking rubber, blinking to silence his ghost. The lost boys took a left on 10th, heading toward the Tony Midtown restaurant area. Two more patrol cars joined the pursuit, all following her lead. Barreling east, the caravan picked up speed, busted red lights, whipped around and scattered traffic. Pedestrians jumped back. Some drivers came to a dead stop, paralyzed by the lights and sirens. Salt was not missing a beat, avoiding the obstacles. Cool on the radio, hot on the road, riding the high and feeling the release. They were headed straight toward Peachtree Street and its skyscrapers that emptied out to trendy shopping and chic restaurants. North side is fixin' to meet south side, Salt thought. The boys veered around a stopped car at Spring Street, scraping a light pole with the rear left wheel. Tire going flat, riding on a rim, they took the turn onto Peachtree. They lost steering and headed across four lanes. Tires squealing, brakes screaming, sparks flying, they were on a collision course with the high brick wall of the Cappuccino Cafe. It was a moment suspended. Northsiders sat under bright flowered umbrellas that shaded their tables, sipping lattes and frappa mochas, looking fine and sleek in dresses and shirts that cost more than a month's rent for the families of the boys in the stolen car. In short seconds, it registered on the coffee drinkers' faces that the metal noises they heard were emanating from a vehicle that was not going to stop in the street. Their mouths and eyes formed little O's. "You're wrong, boys, but you're my wrong, boys.
It's not often we bring the battle here. Johnny C. hit the wall at just the right place to do no real damage, bricks busting and flying. She was laughing. She'd seen these boys scramble unscathed from many stolen cars. They knew how to wreck and roll. Dust filled the shining, sunlit afternoon. Patrons scrambled against overturned tables, dodging spilling drinks. Both doors of the stolen car were pinned shut, the car wedged between the wall and a parked car. Salt went left, Pepper right, both cruisers coming to a stop on the sidewalk beside the rear fenders of the car. Simultaneously, they swung from their cars, guns drawn, and scrambled up to the driver's and passenger side windows. Pepper ordered Johnny and Half-Dead to keep their hands where they could be seen. It took the rest of the shift for Salt and Pepper to write the reports and pound the car and get the boys in the wagon bound for the Gray Bar Hotel. Other than the Buick and the brick wall, there were no injuries except coffee stains on the stylish couple who jumped quickest mid-sip. A good-looking crowd gathered to watch Johnny and Half-Dead do the perp walk to the wagon. Smiling Pepper announced, "Your tax dollars at work." Later that night, the precinct humorists were swearing that Salt and Pepper had asked Johnny C. and Half-Dead at gunpoint, "Will that be calf or decaf, boys?" Or that while they cuffed Johnny and Half, they told the waiter they would take their lattes to go. But as she was transferring her gear to the Honda, she wondered if Lil D might have waited for her behind the school, that he just might have cared enough to want to hear about his dad. It gnawed at her that once again she might have let that family down. There seemed no way to do right without collateral damage. Chapter 17. Dirty Red. It was toward the hottest part of the day, late afternoon sun still baking the streets, when Salt drove down Meldon, looking for Dirty Red's sister's house. She rolled the lobe of her right ear, still tender from a pavement scuffle the night before, between her thumb and finger, and felt herself overly annoyed by the loss of the little silver stud earring whose mate she still had in her left ear. Hot wind came in through the four open windows of the cruiser. The houses on Meldon were cousins to her own old house out in the country, built in the same era and style. But here, near the homes, the houses were vulnerable and falling fast. Some of the roofs were caving in on a third story or attic. Windows were boarded up, decorative trim rotted. They were unevenly spaced on the street because so many had been torn down. Using Glenda's backstory on Red, she'd asked around and had been directed to a house on Meldon, where people said the sister lived. Next door to the house, weeds overran the lot and grew between piles of bricks. Vines wrapped an old fire-scorched chimney. The instant she got out of the car, she was startled by a loud snap, a crack in the air above. Salt grabbed for her holster. With quick relief, she saw that a blue plastic tarp covering at least half of the house's gabled roof had come loose on one side and was flapping loudly in the wind. The gaudy blue stood out in bright plastic contrast to the gray, weathered siding. A broken concrete walk led to the front steps and up to an ill-fitting, hollow core door that someone had put their foot through, leaving a splintered hole in the bottom panel. The original door would have been solid oak. She stepped to the side and knocked on the cheap wood. A large, light-skinned, freckle-faced woman partially opened the door. "Is Red here?" asked Salt, not being sure if she or her sister would like her being called Dirty. "Which Red? Me? Or Dirty? I'm Big Red." "Well, I was wanting to talk to Dirty Red." Salt hid her grin with a cough. "What the police want with her?" She didn't open the door any farther. I'm Officer Salt, and first, I wanted to make sure she's all right. From behind the large sister, another woman's voice, let her in. Opening the door only a little more, Big Red turned to speak to whoever the second voice belonged to.
As if you ain't brought enough trouble to this house.
Salt stepped in, just barely clearing the door before Big slammed it shut behind her. The house was dark and cool. A small tunnel of light coming from the kicked-in hole in the door shone down the hallway, where a skinny woman was leaning with her shoulder against the wall. The woman's features were hidden in the dim, but she had the disjointed, jittery posture and stance of a crack user. Chanel, Salt said, even though she knew better. Before she could adjust her eyes to the dark rooms and the bright backlighting, the figure moved and turned into the woman she assumed to be Dirty Red, completely naked. She went through a doorway, sauntering past Salt and into a large living room, lifted a dusty drapery, peeked out the front window, then turned back and told Salt, still standing in the hall,
"You in now? You might as well come all the way in." "Good God, girl," said Big Red, "put some clothes on. I ain't gonna hear this. Best I know nothing."
She plodded out and down the hall, leaving them alone. Flopping down on an old brocade sofa, Dirty Red said,
"Ain't nothing the police ain't seen before. Besides, it's too hot."
Salt felt her sweat-soaked undershirt plastering itself under the bulletproof vest and felt a familiar admiration. In her, like Chanel, there would be no pretension, which was always a relief. She pulled at her vest to let some air get to her skin.
"Why you say Chanel when you come in?" asked Dirty Red,
flinging her limbs around an arm of the sofa, swinging her legs open and closed. Salt was used to this lack of modesty, having searched so many whores after they were arrested. The male cops were always calling female cops for the close body searches of female arrestees. The whores, most of the time, without even being asked, pulled their pants down and their shirts up, displaying breasts and showing pink without the least bit of inhibition. "I never even saw my own mother naked," Salt realized. "You and Chanel hung together," answered Salt, feeling the weight of all the gear on her belt. The streets forged strange intimacies. She, who'd never argued with her parents, now had this job, which sometimes involved close combat. Salt had lain on top of man when she and other officers struggled to get him handcuffed. Just after the cuffs were on, man asked in a friendly manner for a quarter for his jail phone call, like nothing unusual had happened. No hard feelings, both of them doing what they do. This conversation with a naked, Dirty Red, who wasn't literally dirty or red, seemed not out of the ordinary.
"Yeah, sometimes. But I hang with lots of folks. Chanel did, too."
"I need your help." Salt shifted her utility belt, adjusting gun, nightstick, gas holder, and radio, then sat down in a chair close by.
"I can't even help my own damn self. I'm down and dirty."
She grinned and grimaced, her nerve endings so shot that she could no longer hold even a simple smile. Chanel was pretty far down herself. Red looked away.
"Nobody know that better than Chanel. Nobody know better than us how low we gone. We the first to tell you."
Salt pictured funky Chanel and her coup de pot pie booty shake. Without the drug tics, Red actually looked very like her sister, freckled and light-skinned, but much, much thinner. Crack gave her grin an unnatural width.
"You don't remember me, do you?" Red asked.
There was something,
Another dim memory. I'm sure I've seen you on the street a couple of times. Salt stood and moved over to the mantel, on which was a photo with curling edges of a school class, one girl circled with a pencil. It was hard to tell which sister it might have been. There was also a ceramic cat meant for a plant, but holding a crack pipe.
No, I mean a long time ago, when I was a kid.
Salt turned back, a vague memory forming. Your sister looks familiar, like a girl I interviewed once.
That was me. We looked alike before I got hooked.
With the memory sharper now, she looked at Red, past the dry, broken hair, past the contortions, the tics, the ashy skin, to the child in the penciled circle.
I was raped, said Red, still smiling.
Your Stone's sister. You and he lived with your auntie on Shaw.
I was 10.
Your uncle. And his.
His daddy. You gave me a teddy bear.
I remember, Salt said, as if words would shatter something already broken.
I still have that bear, but I've forgotten where.
Salt had more bears in the trunk of her car. I guess by now he's seen better days.
Hell, I ain't, said Red.
She swung her feet to the floor and leaned towards Salt.
I ain't. Chanel dead. She ain't hurtin' no more, but I'm still here.
Whoever killed Chanel needs to get caught. I heard your brother beat you up a little while back.
You know what? He dead before he dead, said Red.
She flung her herky-jerky body to the far side of the room. For a moment, Salt thought she might be searching for the bear, but Red grabbed a pack of cool cigarettes off the mantel. Are you staying here because your sister can protect you?
Yeah. Stone won't mess with my sister because she's really his mama.
You mean your sister is your brother's mother?
You a smart police.
Salt's head was beginning to hurt. It had started again last night, and now the wavy lines in her vision were back. She wanted to do right for Chanel, but at the same time wanted to be away from the images of little girls who had to make do with nothing for a childhood, and who ended up easy to get killed. Who might have wanted Chanel dead?
Chanel like me. One wrong turn and we liable to get a bad surprise. We at the bottom, like nothing. But I still got big till she don't have no more money. Then I got the street again. I ain't quite at the real bottom. Chanel ruined what she have with Big D. She was on the last step. Anybody could have killed her.
Was she doing something different? Something that would have put her next to a killer?
Now, officer, you been round these streets. Every next person might be ready to kill. Say a person don't get their piece of the chicken. Don't get a decent night's sleep. Get disrespected by the boys on the corner. Don't take much more and they just kill. Question for me is, when they ready?
Did Stone or Mann or any of the gang have regular contact with Chanel?
I ain't answering on the grounds that it might intimidate me. I know my rights.
She swung her legs again, open, closed, like a child, a 24-year-old crack child on short time. The white shimmers in Salt's sight danced faster. She gave it another shot. I'm not trying to intimidate you. You're not under investigation. She tugged again at the ear, missing its silver. Red lit the cool and blew smoke up toward the ceiling.
I know when to shut up. I learned that a long time ago. I never had no protection. I had that bear for a while. I always did what I was told, till that bear. I told that bear what I wanted. Then he got lost.
Salt had found the right house, and now she wanted out. She stood suddenly and turned toward the dim hall. Red said.
You find your own way out.
At the thresholds of the living room, she half turned. It's my job to find who killed Chanel. Just like if you were killed. I'd keep on until I caught them. Little girls don't get too much say around here, and they damn sure don't say much once they're grown and dead.
Salt's muscles tightened. Her boots hit hard on the old floor, heading into the shaft of light from the damaged door.
Behind her, she thought she heard Red say,
"Bears ain't no protection."
Outside, Salt hurried to the privacy of the cop car. The hot wind continued to pull and lift the blue tarp, covering the Red sister's house. Chapter 18. On the Way Home. Wednesday night was brutal. Nothing major, but radio had been relentless. Call after call, dispatch constantly asking units to clear, advising that there were numerous high-priority calls pending. There had been no time to needle the gang. It worried her that she had not caught sight of Lil D. Salt had gulped a power drink on the run and had to milk a call to take a bathroom break and to refill her water bottle. By the time the shift ended, her vest was soaked. Her gear bag felt like it carried a ton of Holmes bricks when she hauled it from the patrol car to her Honda. None of the guys were joking, hardly even talking. They were all exhausted, too exhausted to complain about manpower shortages in the PD, or the dearth of patrol cars, or the politics that at times played hell with the police budget, as they had in the most recent years. Mostly it was just the muffled sounds of trunks closing. Uniform shirts came off, then the vests. White undershirts appeared disembodied in the dark parking lot. Salt stowed her gear, vest, and bag. Her t-shirt began to dry. Her skin breathed again. Pepper stumbled to his minivan, parked next to Salt, and sat with the door open, his head on the steering wheel.
"I'm so tired, I don't think I can get the key in the ignition."
"I don't know how I'm going to make the drive home. Thank God it's Friday," she mumbled.
"It's Wednesday," Pepper said.
"Well, it's our Friday, and I'm going home," she said, eager for the pecan trees, the sheep, and her black dog.
"Good night, partner."
Salt steered out of the drive and cut through a few short streets to get to the expressway. Stopped at the last light on Love Street, before the expressway entrance ramp, her hand moved to cover the butt of her 9mm, and she realized that, distracted by fatigue, she had left the gun on her belt in the trunk. But she was so close to open air, close to being away from the city. She headed onto the expressway, her mind gone to thoughts of the coming days off, her dog, and home. Half an hour later, waiting for the light at the top of the off-ramp exit to her country town, she was jolted out of her reverie by the heavy thump-thump of a loud car speaker, its vibration shaking the frame of her Honda. With the windows rolled up, air conditioner on full blast, no words came through, just the jolting bass beats. In the rearview mirror, behind the car directly behind her, she could see the top of a yellow truck, shaking with the blaring sound. When the light changed, she made the right turn onto the rural two-lane that led directly home. The decked-out Chevy truck turned behind her, sped up, and filled her rearview mirror. It was familiar, from the corner, from the chicken place. A gang car. The windows of the truck were dark-tinted, so it was impossible to tell how many people were in the cab. She maintained her normal speed, but her heart began to race. There were 5 miles of unlit blacktop before her winding dirt driveway, but no way would she lead them to her home. The truck began to accelerate around her. In a split second, Salt considered her options. There were only old farmhouses between the expressway and home. If the truck pulled alongside her, she would be an easy target. If she slowed to turn back, same possibility. She would not put some old farm family in danger by turning into their drive. That left one option. She floored it. The Honda seemed to gulp a second before responding to the infusion of fuel. The 6-year-old sedan was not built for speed, but Salt felt she had one advantage. She had been driving this road since she was 16, and it was a sticky blacktop. She knew every turn, how they were banked. She'd slipped off its shoulders enough times to know where the ditches were deep and where they were shallow. If she could make it, 10 miles out, there was a small town speed trap where the local sheriff filled the town coffers with fines levied on unsuspecting out-of-towners. The truck rammed her from the rear. Salt's chest hit the steering wheel as the car jolted toward the right ditch. How to make the 10 miles? The first of the curves appeared, and she knew exactly how far into the curve she could keep up speed. She anticipated the apex and maximized acceleration coming out of the bend. Salt watched in the mirror as the truck decelerated too soon, and for a brief moment she lost sight of it as she hit the gas coming back on the straightaway. But it was a mile to the next real bend in the road, and the headlights were shining closer again in the mirror, hurting her eyes and messing with her night vision. She downshifted to get more grip for the car, risking the transmission, turned the AC off to get more power, and left the windows up to minimize air resistance. Sweat poured from her face and neck. She couldn't think of any way to get more advantage for her small car. The truck rammed her again and knocked the rear right wheel off the edge of the road. She fought to hold the car straight before angling back onto the road surface. No longer tired, her body flooded with adrenalized instinct, the earlier longing for the soothing silk of dog fur and home now replaced by primitive determination. For an irrational second, she considered the sheep and that their hooves needed to be treated for rot. This time, when the truck slammed into the car, she felt the jerk and then a tug from the bumper biting into her left rear tire. The next curve appeared, and she remembered one more accessory to eliminate. She flipped off her lights coming out of the curve, hoping that she was far enough ahead that the truck occupants would, at least briefly, lose sight of her, that there was enough moonlight to see by, that her eyes would adjust quickly enough, that the tire wouldn't go flat, and that the Honda would hold up for a few minutes more. She knew that another curve would come almost as soon as this one ended, and she quickly accelerated, decelerated, downshifted, and tore out of the apex, following moonbeams on the white lines of pavement. Sighting down the bridge over the recently dry Billy's Creek, crossing the bridge, she slammed on the brakes, cut the Honda sharply to the right, just as the bridge railing ended, and fishtailed down the bank to the rocky creek bed. She dared not lose momentum on the sharp, dry rocks, keeping the car grinding and bumping for traction back up the incline, timing it for just after the truck passed over the bridge. Now she was following them, her lights still off as the truck poured on speed, searching for her ahead. The sharpest curve on the stretch loomed unannounced because the sharp curve ahead sign had not been replaced after the last accident victim took it down, coming out of the curve from the other direction. Even with her windows up, the impact was loud, and seconds later, the explosion vibrated to her car. The glow became visible as she drove slowly, car limping with the flattening rear tire. Then, around the bend, the night lit up by the truck burning against the base of a large pine tree. Salt stopped on the shoulder at a safe distance. The truck had struck the tree sideways on the passenger side, just behind the cab. The doors had crumpled inward, but the windows had somehow stayed unshattered. Fully engulfed, fire filled the cab. It was impossible to see if it was one person moving behind the tinted windows or two people being consumed by the flames. She got out and went to the trunk for her phone in the side pocket of her gear bag. She held the phone in her palm, popping sounds from the burning car, murder on her ears, fire shooting up the trunk of the tall pine. Needles caught like white sparklers, spraying the ground. She pocketed the phone, closed the bag, pushed aside the gear belt with the 9mm, and grabbed for the spare tire. Using the light from the fire, she worked as fast as she could with the rusty jack. She pounded the lugs loose with the wrench, changed the tire, and then sped down the road to home. In the hall, the first lavender light of day was showing, coming from between the top of the living room curtains and the sills. She sat at the kitchen table in the faint light, a half glass of red wine, a black gun cleaning kit, and the chrome 9mm laid out in still life. Salt took a sip of wine and released the clip from the gun. She separated the slide from the frame and drained the glass. Her nostrils filled with the smells of gun oil and fermented fruit as the first rays of sun crept down the hallway. The light played attractively on the chrome. With a weapon still in pieces, she put her head on the table and fell into a sleep without dreams. There was a large turnout, 75 or more, for the funeral of Q-Ball. Salt kept out of sight, on a street crest overlooking the attendees, above the stone church where a good number of dope boys had been eulogized in the past. Two columns of young men in colors filed into the church. A floral spray in the same blue was carried behind them, the number 13 outlined in white carnations. Blessing had mentioned that he'd heard Q-Ball was killed in a wreck. "Highway 14, isn't that out where you live?" Pepper noticed the pulled-out dent in the bumper of her Honda. "How'd you get that?" Nobody that she knew of put it all together, though. The county sheriff didn't come asking. There was no record. She had not made the call. Nothing to tie her to Q-Ball and the chase on the road to her house. Salt would not risk being seen as not able to handle her beat. She would not risk being taken out of the homes. There were still supervisors who felt protective of the women cops and would see this kind of incident as too much of a threat. She would deal with it. No one in the city cared where Q-Ball had crashed and died. Just another dead ganger. No one, except maybe Man and Salt. Chapter 19. Sister Connolly. In the dark heat, Salt slowly trailed along Marcy Street, windows down in the black and white. A hot, misty rain had fallen during the day, and now a heavy fog hung over the night. The streetlights had halos, and the white noise of the city was muffled. The tires crunched on bits of gravel and glass. An ethereal cloud cloaked the street. There hadn't been much radio traffic, the mic on her shoulder mostly silent. From where Salt parked down the street, low visibility made her view of Sister Connolly in a red choir robe all the more startling as Sister approached from the apartment side of the street, moving toward her house. The colors of the houses, the street, a close-by mimosa, were hazy and muted to shades of dark and gray, all except the blood red of Sister's robe and the cracked red of Chanel's windows across the street. Salt used the outside car mic to announce herself. "Hello." Her greeting floated, disconnected. Sister stopped in front of her gate and waited as Salt drew up, her robe redder the closer Salt got, the pleats folding and unfolding as she moved. "You're out late tonight. Coming from church?" Even her unamplified voice seemed to expand.
"Prayer meeting and choir practice. You don't think I wear this just to wander around in, do you?"
Her words were also magnified in the muted night.
"You making fun of something with that microphone?"
Salt turned off the ignition and got out, her hands on her gear belt to keep things from jangling. She shut the car door quietly, only the click of the latch audible, and moved closer to Sister, who seemed in this light both younger and more ancient. You didn't really answer my questions about Chanel when I came by last week. Sister stepped closer.
You ever go to church?
I was raised in the church, Salt said.
Salt. Now that makes me think of Lot's wife, who got herself turned into a pillar of salt when she looked back at evil.
It's my job to look. Sister turned with a swish of red and started up the steps.
Come with me.
The porch light flickered with moths. One hit Salt in the mouth as she followed up the steps and into the dark house. The old woman switched on a dim lamp beside her worn armchair, sat down, smoothed the robe over her knees, and motioned for Salt to sit on the flowered divan across from her.
You say it's your job to look at evil. What do you really know?
It didn't come out like a question.
You've been around the homes for 10 years. That's a blink of an eye for me. My eyes saw evil before your daddy was born.
I don't see how this relates to Chanel, said Salt, realizing the conversation was getting away from her again. The place where she sat on the divan was sprung. She was sunk in a low spot, her knees higher than her lap.
Tell me what you see that's evil, demanded Sister.
Stone hurts people because it makes him feel good.
Oh, I know that. And how did that get in him?
The old woman was asking questions in the rhythm of a catechism. Then, sitting forward, her face above the lamplight, her red robe shining, she said,
I'll tell you answers you don't have questions for. I knew his great-granddad from down in Hayhira, before they all come up here to find work. He whipped his grandchildren like he whipped his mule, and he whipped his mule hard leaving Hayhira.
She picked up an old scrapbook and began to turn the black pages of yellowed newspaper clippings stuck in between the seams. She stopped at one clipping, handed the album to Salt, and pointed. Negroes Burn Sharecropper Store. It was from an old county weekly, dated 1959. Salt studied a photo of burning shanties. Why are you showing me this? What does it have to do with now?
You say you think you've seen evil, but stone carries a curse. Curse different from evil.
I can't undo what's past, and it doesn't explain what happened to Chanel, or what will happen to the next person who gets in Stone's way. Salt handed the scrapbook back. Sister Connolly leaned over the book, into the light, and said,
You got a curse, too. Maybe just like your daddy, I'm sorry to say. You think you cursed same as your daddy? You have to get close to people. Maybe too close?
Salt shifted to the front edge of the couch, readying herself to stand. Talking about her father in a conversation about Chanel's murder was making her uneasy.
Hold on now.
Sister motioned her down.
We all got some kind of curse. Don't take it personal. Curse can be a blessing, depending. Why you think Stone killed Chanel?
Because he likes to hurt people. Because he hurt his own sister. Because Man and the gang aren't talking, even though I've arranged for some of them to be in jail. I've always suspected that Man doesn't understand how damaged Stone is, how he's a double-edged sword.
Sister held up her hand to stop Salt. Why? Why would he kill her? Why would anybody kill her?
Posing the questions like teaching, not asking. Salt sat there silently staring at the hem of the choir robe, then said, I don't know. It doesn't seem like a killing for pleasure. She wasn't tortured, didn't have anything to steal. Maybe she was shot because she did something to somebody, or as a warning.
Maybe as a lesson, like a Sunday school lesson, Sister Connolly said.
Salt was getting tired of the cryptic nature of the conversation. What do you know? Also, the way you talk makes it seem like you knew my dad pretty well. Moving her face back into the shadow, Sister said,
All's I know is what I know.